I'm just going to give the developers a little warning. We'll get started in just a minute, but we're going to switch to vascular access, and we'll ask each of the developers, KCQA, CMS, and SBS, to introduce their measures. And then we're going to ask the group that reviewed this set of measures to help us prioritize if there's any ones that you think there were issues or questions that would benefit from full discussion. If not, we'll just select which ones we start with. So we'll get started in just a moment. Just wanted to give you a little advance.
Okay, let's call the meeting back to order. And so at this point, we'd like to welcome the measure submitters for vascular access to give a brief presentation of your metrics, after which we're going to discuss exactly what order we're going to attack them at. So shall we start with, is someone on from SVS on the phone?
Is Lindsay Adams on the phone?
Are the phone lines open?
Phone lines are open.
Okay.
Okay.
So if Lindsay's not there yet, let's go to HCQA.
KCQA. Okay, thank you.
Kidney Care Partners. Please go ahead.
Okay. Again, I'm Lisa McGonigal from Kidney Care Quality Alliance, which is an alliance of patient advocates, healthcare professionals, care providers, and purchasers convened by Kidney Care Partners to develop performance measures for ESRD care. KCQA is pleased to have submitted information for two vascular access measures for continued NQF endorsement. Measure 0251, which is vascular access, functional AVF, or evaluation by vascular surgeon for placement, and measure 0262, catheter vascular access and evaluation by vascular surgeon for permanent access. Both measures were endorsed by NQF in 2008, and they're included among CMS's Phase 3 clinical performance measures. The Phase 3 CPMs are slated for use by CMS in its Crown Web Dialysis Facility Data Repository when it becomes functional. Both measures have been demonstrated as reliable and valid through field testing, which was performed both in clinician offices, coincident with the AMA PCPI renal measures, and at 53 dialysis facilities across the United States. The underlying rationale for both measures is to minimize the use of catheter vascular access and maximize permanent access placement and use in all eligible hemodialysis patients, as is consistent with the current KDOQI clinical practice guidelines for vascular access and a large and growing body of evidence demonstrating the superiority of permanent access types over catheters. We note that the KCQA vascular access measures are unique to the NQF renal performance measures portfolio in that they focus not only on outcomes, that is the percentage of patients with a permanent access, but also on the process of ensuring that those patients without permanent access are seen and evaluated by a vascular surgeon for placement. We'd like to thank the steering committee and NQF for your consideration of these measures, and we welcome any questions either now or after your deliberations.
Thank you. Representative for CMS.
For the sake of time, we'll not make any major comments other than to remind you all as you deliberate that our two measure submissions, our measure submissions are linked, that we feel that the maximization of AV fistula and minimization of catheter need to be taken as a linked set of measures. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is SVS Lindsay? Is it on the phone now? Okay, we'll defer for a bit. We know they're expected to be on in the near future. So let's have a... Karen and I sort of had an arbitrary order, but we wanted, before we decide which one to start with, we thought we would ask the committee, and particularly those who review these metrics, if they felt that one or more of them are important for more important for the committee to discuss in person today as opposed to possibly being deferred to a phone meeting. So Andrew already told us that his could probably, the one of his catheter rate
256 could wait.
Could probably wait because he believes it's pretty straightforward. And other comments from reviewers?
It might be good to discuss 0259 as a group. Hemodialysis vascular access, the decision making by surgeon to maximize placement of AVF.
Okay. That actually was kind of number one on our list for whatever reasons. So other comments from reviewers, preferences?
Okay. Then why don't we go...
Oh, we can't do that one yet.
No, we won't do that one yet. But why don't we do one of the... let's do 0251, which is a KCQA measure, and Jerry Jackson was the... our lead discussant.
You want to start with that one? Yeah. Scroll it up. Okay, This measure is vascular access functional AV fistula R evaluation by vascular surgeon for placement. This measure steward is KCQA, is for endorsement. It is a clinician level measure.
Yes, that's right. And just a distinction, I'm sorry. The CMS measures would be facility level. This is the clinician level measure.
I believe we were all agreed that the importance to measure and report was high to moderate. Cool. Let me look at that specifically.
I apologize, this is Lorian again. I was just clarifying the measure we're reviewing right now.
0251.
0251, thank you.
Right. And we'll start with impact, Jerry. So we know the initial reviewers indicated everyone was in agreement it was high impact. So maybe we could go ahead and vote on that and then move on?
Yes, all the reviewers agree to
the
time.
All right. Oh.
We don't have a...
We need to vote. Okay, so we're on 0251. Vascular access, functional AVF. Oh, Jerry, I jumped the gun here. Would you give us a description of the measure? I'm sorry. Totally sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, the... let me get back. Keep switching between screens here. Okay, the numerator is... the number of the patients from the denominator who have a functional AV fistula using two needles for cannulation or do not have a fistula with two needles being used but have been evaluated by a vascular surgeon or other surgeon that's qualified to place vascular access for the placement of an AV fistula at least one time during a 12-month time frame. And the denominator statement are all patients aged 18 and over on hemodialysis during the 12-month period who have been on dialysis for greater than 3 months or 90 days. and there are no denominator exclusions. And the data collection can be from any variety of sources.
Okay, so I think we can go to voting on the impact. Any other discussion? All right. Well,
one other thing is the steward of the, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, me.
List of this is an outcome measure, and I think it's either intermediate outcome or process.
I think in the past we had these categorized as process measures, but, you know, this is one of those areas where you could kind of look at it in different ways, but I think the other ones, I think we've had it categorized as process in the past.
I can just ask a quick question. It doesn't relate to the vote, but on the survey form that was developed that goes along with this, it asks whether or not the patient's in hospice, and I'm just curious as to whether that was meant to be an exclusion in the denominator because it's not indicated as such.
And do you want to answer that right off the top?
It was a combined form for the two measures, so that question pertains to the other KCQA measure.
So exclusion. Okay, so there's no exclusion. Okay, so let's vote on impact, and then we'll get into the more specific opportunities.
Okay, voting is open.
Lorian, impact?
Aye. Is that 20? That's 20.
Okay.
All right. Let's do it. The voting is all 20 votes were for high impact. So the next vote would be for performance gap.
Right. Now that there were two modes of data collection that were carried out at the time of the first submission of the measure. There was a wide cross-section of facilities that were looked at, and then seven MD practices, and they were not. Overlapping. I'm pretty sure that the MD practices were different than the facilities. The performance, as judged by this, the specifications, was 72% on the MD offices and 84% by facilities. And that was judged to be a gap in performance, although there was not, I did not see other data presented that drilled down more to individual, the gap between individual physicians. But there is a gap, and if 100% is the target, then there is a gap in performance.
Okay, other reviewers, any comments or other committee members about performance gap in this area? Honey?
I think my concern was, again, this is at a clinician-physician level, and this performance gap was really done based on facility-level review for the most part. And I also feel that the goal of 100% is an unrealistic goal.
Well, let me just clarify, the goal is not part of the measure, I think, you know, so again, it's like we talked about before, performance measures, you know, better is, more is better, but there's not, like, it's that you have to read a certain threshold.
But, if I could interject, I think that comment was based on the percentages put into the application by the developer as representative of a performance gap. When my interpretation of 72% by the MD practice is 72% of what I'll ask the developer that question. Was the 72% of performance by the MD offices based on a projection of 100%? Or what's the 72% of?
Two things. The first issue, to the point of that it was, this is a facility testing. It was tested in facilities, but the level of analysis that's reported here is to the physician. It was just at the facility's records for you. So I did want to clarify that. And then did you want to clarify the relative, the question of whether there's a gap compared to what? I mean, ideally, yes, 100% of people would have some kind of permanent access.
That's what the reported percentages refer to, is if it were
right.
Completely fulfilled. Okay.
Could you repeat that? We couldn't hear.
The percentages reported in the MD, the performance in the MD offices of 72% and 84% in facilities was based on the ideal of complete adherence to this, or 100%.
I'm sorry, just help me. I'm a little confused, because the performance gap ought to be measured as those people who didn't fulfill the criteria of this measure, and I don't see that data here. Do we have any information on the performance gap?
No.
The performance range from 33 to 100%, so, and we do report that.
Where is it?
So there's a high degree of variability.
Right, I'm sorry, it's not a matter of which access people have, but whether they fulfill the criteria of these specifications. Do we have that? If we do, I'm sorry, could you just point us to that?
No, that is, these are measures of people who either have the AVF or were seen by a physician, which is fulfilling the criteria of this measure. The performance in the facility was 84.4%, with a range from 33 to 100, which is substantial variability, demonstrating a gap, and a mean performance rate of 72% within physicians' offices.
Was there a range reported on the MD office data?
It was not reported, but I actually do have that data. I could probably dig that up pretty easily.
That's one of the things that several of the reviewers commented on, is that the data for facilities does not directly apply to a physician level measure. So we're trying to get to performance gap by physicians.
With this particular measure, the data source that's used to report this measure is feasible through facility-based records. Testing in the physician's office required the Iowa Foundation for Medical Care to have both facility and the physician office records. So the best data source for this to then analyze at the level of physicians is the facility's records.
Okay, and the information on opportunity for improvement presented in the submission was based on their collecting data based on the specifications for this measure. And maybe you should just clarify, because the original measure was not specified necessarily to be collected out of facility records or Crown Web data. It was CPT-2 code, so maybe it's no longer specified that way, correct, with CPT-2 code?
We specified it so that with the intent that it would be collected via Crown Web, which would require chart review to enter the data into Crown Web, but we also went ahead and specified out codes that we included in the data dictionary. It was not tested using the codes. It was tested using chart review.
Okay.
Summarize what we've learned about the performance gap.
Well, I think Lauren's got the information up on the screen now about performance gap. And obviously, you know, the idea is for patients to either have AVF or to be evaluated for placement. And given that that measure is either or, the expectation it should be pretty high. And so, like all performance gap information, it's relative to the severity of the problem. And so the data they presented was that there is, you know, any variation in performance, and overall patients are not always getting either the AVF or being seen by a surgeon for potential placement. So any other comments about that or disagreements?
And this is in a sample of 1,700 patients, so it doesn't reflect national data. And so I'm wondering if this, has there been improvement? Has this been done serially, and has the gap closed since initial endorsement in those facilities or healthcare entities that use the metrics?
This was originally endorsed under a time-limited status, so the testing was done between September 1st and the end of August 2009. Since then, we have not gone out to look at longitudinal data. The published literature would suggest, though, that there still remains an issue with 72% of people or something of that nature starting dialysis with a catheter.
Thank you. Okay. So is the committee ready to vote on performance gap? Okay, let's do it.
And Lorian, performance gap? I'm sorry, what was that? Lorian, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Now I can.
Hi.
Thank you.
Okay, 3 votes high, 17 moderate, 1 insufficient. So we decided this is not an outcome and we should look at the body of evidence, right?
Okay. The evidence primarily reviewed 4 studies. None of them were randomized controlled trials. The evidence focused on the better outcomes with fistulas compared to other types of access, the lower cost, lower complication rate, lower hospitalizations, and things along those lines. So the evidence was not precisely aligned with the measure focus, but certainly implied the direction of the measure focus.
Other reviewers, any comments about the evidence? So the specifics about the evidence was about the lower rate of complications with use of AVF, which is very relevant to the measure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there were 4 studies cited, so we can vote. I think on the quantity.
And, yeah.
Okay. All right, so let's vote on the quantity.
Gloria?
We'll go 20. All right. Everyone's getting good at reading and following the chart. 20 voted moderate. Okay, now to the quality. So you mentioned that of the four, there was one, there was no randomized clinical trials, that they support the notion that AVF is good. Nothing that was directly studying the metric that AVF is, or referral to a surgeon is good. Is that a good summary?
Yes. Okay.
Others? Other comments?
Other reviewers? Andy or Connie, anything to add about evidence?
I mean, the only comment I would have, of course, part of the measure is to refer to a vascular surgeon. That surgeon may well do vein mapping and decide an AV fistula is not a good choice for that patient and put in a different graft. I mean, and put in a graft. This is still a good clinical outcome from a clinical nephrologist standpoint, but doesn't have nothing to do with fistulas in this case, except that it's a good evaluation of a patient of what is best for that individual, but somewhat, you know, circumstantial.
Does the specification say that the surgeon has to have a plan for an AVF, or just that the patient be evaluated or referred? Evaluated.
I was going to get to that in, under the reliability and specifications, but it's documented in one of four ways. The nephrologist can dictate a note into the patient's chart. The surgeon can dictate a note. The staff member at dialysis can dictate a note. And then if the surgeon chooses, for whatever reason, not to place a fistula, that reason needs to be documented in the patient's chart. So there's those very specific specifications that allow that to occur.
And just a little bit of history. The last project where this was reviewed, there was discussion about referral, and the committee really strongly encouraged, and the measure was modified at that time to actually include evaluation, not just that there was some referral. Right. So that.
So that word has been changed.
Right.
The,
right.
You know, it's actual evaluation. So.
All right. Should we move on?
Okay, so we ready to vote on the quality of the evidence? Let's do it.
And Lorian?
Moderate.
Nineteen moderate, too low. Okay, and consistency. Jerry, any thoughts?
No. I think the consistency that fistulas are better than anything else is high. I mean, the relationship of the evaluation by the surgeon component of this is not well studied, so I think, you know, how does that change? I'd like other people to comment on that. How does that change the assessment of consistency?
Well,
and that was my concern, too. I mean, I think there's a very strong case for obviously having fistulas, but there's not a strong case that this process, that the behavior that's mandated in this measure is going to lead to that.
For instance, just on drilling down a little bit, the process varies by location, but for the most part, our surgeons want a mapping done prior to them seeing the surgeon. Sometimes that mapping indicates something different, and it might affect where they go. So it's going to be done a variety of ways in different places, but obviously, evaluation by a surgeon, whatever that means, has to occur before they place a fistula. So I'm not sure that is that germane to the consistency question.
Alan?
I think this is asking us a question about the consistency of the data, not of our process. So
right.
You've already said you think the consistency of the data are high. we do need to talk some more about the process and perhaps unintended consequences of this.
Fair enough.
Okay, so can we vote on consistency? Any objections? All right, here we go.
And Lorian?
Moderate.
7 votes for high, 14 moderate. So it does pass the evidence decision logic grid with a yes. And so we don't need this. And we did meet all 3 sub-criteria, right?
Right.
Okay. We don't need this one. So measure properties, reliability and specifications.
On reliability, there was, I think, a very high-level discussion in the application. They had gone back and done data integrity audits in 11 out of 53 sites that I think were at facilities. And then on both the ND office and facilities, there was inter-writer reliability that was assessed that had high Kappa scores. So at that level of reliability, I personally thought that was impressive. If I could go on, can I talk about specifications right here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One major issue I had with specifications is that because of the problem with increasing catheters and other issues, there's been a slight upward blip in the prevalence of grafts. For patients who have a graft that is functioning well, or even who has an occasional intervention, according to KDOQI guidelines, that person would not need evaluation for a fistula as yet. It would be when the graft starts failing or has, I believe, 3 interventions within a 6-month block of time that they would need to be referred for evaluation for a secondary fistula. So I think there's an issue in the specifications with leading to the unintended consequence of overuse for the approximately 15% of people who have grafts that are functioning well that would be required by this to see a surgeon annually for fistula evaluation. So any comments from Connie or others?
I agree with that. I think there's another unintended consequence, and it's for those patients that have catheters that have been evaluated by a surgeon and have been deemed to have access never, meaning no, at no point will they be able to have an ABF or an ABG. And so, again, the burden of those people having to be evaluated by a surgeon when it's been deemed that they won't not be able to have a vascular access of ABG or ABF.
I suppose there could be a specification of requiring a second opinion in that.
Or have them be part of an exclusion criteria.
Right. Yeah. Hospice would be another, like Jeff mentioned,
yes.
Would be another exclusion.
So it sounds like we're getting into some validity issues with how it's specified.
Right.
And it rather than, and I know that this is seems like splitting hairs, but just to help us kind of keep things in category and give the right feedback, the specifications as they are pretty precise, and you indicated the reliability. And then I think this is good discussion that we definitely need to bring into the validity question.
But don't you think, Jerry, I mean, what I heard you mentioning is also what Andrew mentioned earlier, is should we have exclusion if they have a working graft?
Right.
That's what I heard.
Could we go ahead and vote? We'll come back to that when we talk about validity. So,
right.
I have one question that may relate to this, but
yeah.
Tell me if not. And that is the definition of a surgeon qualified in the area of vascular access and whether that is something that was, if the reliability of that assessment was determined. No, that's a judgment call that may or may not be correct.
Right, and that's a good, you know, how is that defined is your question, right? Yeah, no, it relates to precision of the specification. So we can ask the developer if they have a definition for that or how they...
Yeah, I know that the measure was originally specified that way to address the issue of remote areas where there would not necessarily be a vascular surgeon present. And in those situations, it would be unfair to not give credit if a patient was referred to a surgeon who does do the vascular access for that area. That was the rationale behind writing it that way.
I would argue the flip side, that there are vascular surgeons who are not qualified to do vascular access.
So,
and I had a question about the data field. You were, are all of these data elements on page 9 going to be in, or is this a combination of using Crown Web and Chart Review? So, for example, note or letter prepared by the nephrologist or the personnel.
All of the access types are a part of the Crown Web data field currently. Crown Web does not currently have a data field for seen in a, or evaluated by a vascular surgeon. However, we have been in discussions with them, and they have indicated their interest in including this measure for next iteration. How they will go about including that data field, we're unable to speak for them at this time, but they do intend to do so.
And just to return to this point, this is a subjective component of this, which is unusual for these performance measures. So I'm not convinced that the wording about appropriate or qualified is really appropriate for this kind of a performance measure, because it confers then an opinion as part of a performance measure that surgeon is in fact qualified.
So would a solution be to just say to a surgeon, and not realizing that?
How about interventional nephrologists that do this? They're not surgeons.
Oh.
Well, this gets to my question about the...
So would it, could you leave out to whom and say evaluated for placement? I'm just...
Well, I think the goal is to get a fistula in as high a percentage of people as possible, and especially for catheter patients, I think it is very necessary for them to be evaluated by a surgeon who's capable of putting in a fistula. And, you know, there's been a lot of small volume writings and literature about the scope or the range of surgical abilities, and there would be many surgeons, maybe the majority, who would say a patient cannot have a fistula, and in fact will have several grafts that fail, and then eventually another surgeon who's a higher skill level operator for fistulas will put in a very well-functioning fistula. So it's extremely subjective when the patient sees any surgeon, whether qualified or not, whether or not they're eligible for a fistula, but I don't know any way to get around that.
But why not do it, Karen, as you suggested, because the processes of care may be variable depending on one's setting, whether it's a transplant surgeon, a vascular surgeon, general surgeon, or interventional nephrologist. If you just say evaluated for, that would just kind of, I just wonder if that's a reasonable way, because I don't know, all of us may operate in different care settings, and how that goes about may be highly variable, and it'd be very difficult to scribe in all those details into this.
It might be reasonable to phrase that patients seen are evaluated by a vascular surgeon or other physician for an AVF. And that would get to the nephrologist issue, it would get to any type of surgeon.
Okay, so where we're at with generally we do this based on the measure as specified. I guess we could ask the developer if they would be amenable to that language, or if we should just maybe we'll just vote on it as it is, and then we can see if there's a recommendation that comes to you. Is that? Well,
yeah.
Let's do that. So
I was going to say, it struck me that you should first vote on it and then recommend what you would like.
Right, right.
To
and
see.
That's what we've been doing. So I won't interrupt
okay.
our process. So we're talking about voting on reliability, and this includes precise specifications and reliability testing.
Okay, any other discussion? Shall we vote? Okay, let's vote.
Florian?
Moderate.
The result, 17 voted moderate and 4 low. So it passes reliability.
Okay. All right.
So keeping the discussion in mind for later, let's go on to validity.
The developer spoke to a process of emphasizing how the sites chosen were highly representative of the broader population. So the sites were well selected and statistically tested. Or representation. Question arose in some of the comments as to whether that was a valid testing of validity in the sense that we're talking about validity. And then that aside, face validity was referenced, but not in a what we'll talk about here is a systematic way. the committee doing that was not listed. And then also the previous endorsement process, the CDP was referenced as face validity, which I'm not sure we accept. Comments?
I have one question about, can we talk about specifications as well as it pertains? And I think I'm just following up on comments. Just rereading this, so I just want to make sure, if I have a patient who their prevalent access, their working access is a graft or a catheter, and they've been on dialysis for, let's say, 10 years, and they were evaluated 2 years ago, or this access was placed 8 or 9 years ago, it's been working fine, I mean, this says a 12-month reporting period. So if they had been evaluated previously outside a 12-month reporting period and were deemed not suitable for a fistula and therefore had a catheter or graft, then they would not meet this measure? Or is that not the way? Because it seems like the 12-month reporting period, I think then every year I have to have them go back and see a surgeon when we've already kind of been down this road.
Wouldn't we need to put in the exclusion that Jerry mentioned earlier for the well-functioning?
Okay, well-functioning graft. I think if they have a catheter, that's a little different situation, especially as surgeons have learned better ways of doing translocation and transpositional fistulas, et cetera. So the skill level has improved. Certainly catheters are a high risk, but if you just look at KDOQI guidelines and common practice, if someone has a well-functioning graft without problems, and they, they need to see a surgeon year after year prior to the time that the graft fails is the point. It's probably about.
If I can just address the issue of graft, I might be able to short circuit this conversation a little bit. As the developers, we tested the measure as it was originally endorsed, but we also gathered information on permanent access broadly, i.e., with graft. So we have the data, and we would be very amenable to a recommendation from the steering committee, not to exclude people from this measure, but to redirect the focus of the measure to be functional permanent access, if you will, or what a permanent access or if you've got a catheter, you need to be evaluated.
Yeah, just part of the specification.
Right. So it was tested as it was endorsed, but we recognized that the shift towards grafts, so we collected that information. The reliability information that you see here is really no different. And we would be amenable to having you recommend it so that, in fact, the measure could more accurately reflect appropriate practice.
I don't want to just, but I mean, I have, there are circumstances where a catheter may be the patient's only option. And I don't want to get on that too much, but I can cite two examples right off the bat. Patients with congenital heart disease, particularly who have transitioned from pediatric to adult populations, some of them will develop high output heart failure with permanent vascular access. Second case is patients who have behavioral or cognitive problems who will not tolerate having two needles in their arm. So I just think there are clinical circumstances that do occur, and I don't know how that would be accommodated in this measure.
Mike, I thought you might say something like that, because I really want to underline this. I think one of the unintended consequences of the Fistula First project was to really ignore patient choices and patient stratification by need. We know that in the best of all worlds, the fistula probably is the best access, but for individual patients, it might either be impossible, impractical, or clearly not the patient's choice for whatever reason. I can tell you in our FHN study, when we looked at our home patients doing 6 times a week at-home dialysis, a substantial portion of those patients use catheters. And we're going to be discussing the vascular access issues at the ASN coming up, but I can tell you that the catheters are not so bad for those people, and the complications are not the ones that have been described before. So I'm just very concerned that what started off here as an overall recommendation about the best type of vascular access that we've learned since then about potential variation and potential patient-centered care that make me concerned about the measure.
And one other thing, looking at some of the older patients, I think it's really cruel to send those people to surgery over and over again, particularly those that are starting dialysis above the age of 80. And we go straight to graft in my program, and they have just fine outcomes. They're not in the hospital constantly, and that needs to be some type of consideration for some of those other older patients.
Well, and that's why we're amenable to the committee recommending that graft be encompassed by the
Yeah, so I'm saying more than just graft, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like when we get to usability, we need to recommend some exclusions as well. But
well, I think what we would need to do is vote on validity, and if these issues about the specifications and whether that makes it a valid indicator of quality, and then if that's the reason that if it doesn't pass this and that's the reason, then we can make the recommendation, and they can come back to you all with that change specification. Does that make sense?
Could I reframe what I said earlier as a question to Karen, and that is, the methods of validation or validity in the application, are they they meet with NQF guidelines on validity?
The discussion about the characteristics of the study sample are not exactly what we're looking for validity of the measure or validity of the data. That certainly provides good evidence about the method that they used for testing the reliability. In face validity, we asked for a systematic assessment, and you know, I think that's something that you all can judge. You know, the fact that it went through NQF endorsement. I mean, what the task force, I guess, had in mind was more about new measures, so I don't think they had necessarily considered that as one of the things that people would present. I think you all can apply your own judgment to face validity as well, or, again, that's something that we could ask them to
provide some more information on.
If I misled, I'm sorry. There was a panel separate from NQF's CDP. The panel members were just not specified in the way that we've had on other applications. So there was a panel, and it was stated that the panel accepted this on face validity. And I believe that's right, isn't that right? Yeah. So there was some level of face validity. It's just that with the new guidelines.
Right. With the new task force guidelines, is that they were recommending that we get more of a systematic assessment of that face validity. Again, on face validity, I think you can either ask for them to do that or kind of go on your judgment of face validity.
Karen, I just wanted to add that we did include all of the names involved in the expert panels that were involved in overseeing the development and approval of these measures down under additional information.
Okay. So you want to just go to that? Any other discussion, questions, clarifications?
So, Karen, are we supposed to vote on the measure as, and then if it does not pass validity, there would be an opportunity for us to make those that have been discussed?
Yes. In a minute, we'll vote on the measure as it currently stands, as it's specified.
I think when I evaluated this measure, and I might have been mistaken, probably was, but when I read the 12 months, those greater than 90 days, I guess in my mind I was thinking of those that just initiated dialysis and had to be seen within that time period. I guess when I look at the validity of it, I guess I just take, you know, what I read in there, and I mean, it just seemed pretty straightforward to me. I didn't drill down to, you know, to evaluate all the, the exceptions or what have you. And I think the number of exceptions to this, the elderly and what have you, that wouldn't be suitable for a fistula, I think that's going to be a very small portion. And I think, to me, the initiation of a fistula is very important. And, you know, I was very fortunate when I got mine. I mean, my doctor, I mean, I don't think he wanted a catheter in me more than 10 days. But my fistula didn't become functional until about 4 or 5 months after it was placed. So I had a catheter for a pretty long time. And one of the happiest days of my life was getting that thing out.
And that is the point about exclusions. I mean, if it's a very small number, then again, it's probably more documentation and data collection burden than contributes to the measure.
Jerry,
could we, when we vote on validity, can we? I know what you just said about voting on what's in the application, but since the developer has already accepted working with us to take functioning graphs out and do a specification modification, can we include that in the consideration for voting?
Well, what we're voting on is validity as presented here.
Okay.
For this metric. Even though it's not perfect, or it could always, you know, there's a lot of considerations, we're going to vote on it as it is here. And then we'll have the opportunity, if we think there's ways it could be improved or things they should consider, we can make those recommendations.
Right.
So are we ready to vote? Okay.
Lorian?
As currently stands, low.
Okay, we have 21 already. Okay, so we have 8 people voting moderate and 13 voting low.
Okay, so let's then see if someone wants to propose a modification to the specifications, and what we can do then is vote on that and ask the developer to come back with those changed specifications. So
to start with, the largest flaw is the graphs should be included in the numerator and denominator. Functioning graphs.
As long as they're functioning well and do not fall under KDOQ guidelines for...
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you very well.
As long as the graphs are functioning well and do not fall under the KDOQ guideline for referral for a new access based on frequency of interventions.
Well, consider that. That may be hard to get into a data form, you know.
Just like
if the last used access was a fistula, that might be as good as we can get, something like that. But anyway, this is advice to make the metric more acceptable and valid for us. Other suggestions to put on the record?
We talked about hospice, talked about elderly patients.
Hospice patients.
Patient choice. At some level, this is out of our hands. You do all you can do, and patient says, I've been dialyzing with a catheter, or my neighbor died with a catheter, or my neighbor bled out from their fistula or whatever, and I'm not going to go see the surgeon. Or they go see the surgeon, and they never get the follow-up appointment to get the surgery performed. So... that's not a sort of the patient's done, the physician has done everything right, and yet there still is a significant number of patients who will never end up getting a navy fistula. I'm not sure how you can.
Oh, I just like to comment on, and having done a lot of QI on vascular access, patients who don't want to, just want their catheter, you know, I think we want to not institutionalize a system where you just let it go at that. You know, that often re-education, bringing the issue up again, sending them to the right surgeon. I mean, some surgeons will look at a patient and say, no way, I'm not going to even try fish. Another one will say, sure, I just did a venogram, here's the place, boom, that's it. So I don't think we should, except maybe in the case of a hospice patient, a patient with a very short life expectancy who does not want the inconvenience of a surgery, maybe you can come up with very few other, maybe a patient who just cannot risk any increased cardiac output for any reason. Other than that, I don't think we should exclude.
I do think the other exclusion is those that have already been evaluated by a cardiovascular surgeon or a vascular access surgeon, and the surgeon deems them unsuitable for either an AVF or an AVG.
Well, again, I'm a little hesitant there for the same reason. There's different surgeons, but consider that. Also, we were kind of worried somewhat about the one-year time horizon. In other words, if a patient was evaluated a year ago and there's a plan for fistula, you know, when the graft fails, or they're not ready to have the fistula put in yet, but they've seen the surgeon, do they need to go back in 12 months? Alan?
Well, Peter, I've heard some difference of opinion around the table about this, and it seems to me we're not going to resolve this, but simply that we need to ask the developer to have heard all of these discussions and arguments, and then to consider what they want to do.
Okay. Yeah, I think we stated into the
audio tape. We're cognizant of the discussions. I think we know what we can do within the data that we have, and we'll come back to you with a revised measure.
And just one other comment about the, except, you know, we do have a facility level measure that's just about AV fistula, and we don't have all these exclusions, and we do need to think about that, again, what's the frequency of these exclusions, what's the, you know, chain differences in distribution, so it's probably a measure that you're not going to get at 100% or 0%, but it's that you have fair comparisons. So we can ask them to address those and come back to you with some analysis and changes. Jeff?
It may get to the point that you mentioned about frequency of exceptions, but the definition of functional fistula really only requires one occurrence with two needles, as I read it. And as you're thinking about revising it, you may want to think about revising that part of the definition as well.
Okay, so I think we can leave this metric now and move on to another. And let's see if SES is on the line. Lindsay or another person?
Yes, I am.
That's Tim Prestwick is on too.
And in the first channel.
Can you, if you're not picking up your handset, please do that. You're coming across kind of distorted.
And could we have one of you give a brief introduction to your measure? This would be 0259.
Yeah, I can do it if you want. This is Tim Preserver. The measure is basically, listening to the last discussion, but it's basically the surgeon's counterpart of patients being referred for vascular access with the concept that to encourage fistula over graft. Again, I'm well aware of all the controversy there, but with the exception that it's based on vein mapping, and the specifications really do allow more than that in terms of physician exclusion based on their judgment that the patient is not a candidate for an AV fistula. So, I mean, it's a pretty simple concept.
Okay, thank you. Reviewer is Connie. So,
this measure is the percentage of patients with advanced chronic disease, CKD 4 or 5, or ESRD undergoing open surgical implantation of a permanent hemodialysis access who receive an AVF. The numerator is the patients undergoing hemodialysis vascular access procedure who have an AVF or who receive an AVF, and then the denominator is all patients with CKD 4, 5, or ESRD who have surgical placement of permanent hemodialysis access. So this is a process measure, and it's at the clinician level. The surgeon. In terms of impact and the importance to measure, I think it was pretty unanimous that this is a high impact, and that AVF have the highest long-term patency rates and lower rates of infection. And so there's there's a high impact in order to for this measure.
Okay, shall we hear any further discussion about the high impact? Alan?
I'm sorry, just before we get there, it's the box of whether or not this has been tested or not is not marked, and so if it's untested, then we're not going to be, as I understand it, not going to be discussing it. Do we know whether it was tested or not?
Is this one we still didn't get the information?
This is, I think this is the one that we don't have that information.
It was submitted previously. This is Tim Kresker again. I was not involved in the testing process, but it has been previously submitted.
Right. So I think that's a good point, and we probably can't continue discussing it at this point. Did you look at the, let me just look. There's some things in here. Go to 2A2. There's some data. That was probably checked incorrectly. There's some reliability testing data.
It's on page 7.
And validity.
And it's basically the CPT and the ICD-9 code. And there were, it looked like, 2 practices.
Yes. So we can go on, and then we'll evaluate that data. Okay. So should we cut?
So I think our
impact, is there any other discussion about impact? Should we vote on that and then go on to the other thing? Is that okay?
Okay, let's vote on high impact, on the impact. High, moderate, low, insufficient. Starting now.
Florian, impact?
Aye.
That's 21. So 17 high, 3 moderate, and 1 low. Okay, on to the performance gap.
Currently, based on the data presented, which was April of 2010, there's a 55% rate of ABF with a goal of 100%, so demonstrated performance gap.
And we should mention this is a previously endorsed measure, so it's up for endorsement maintenance. And did they provide information on the actual measure?
Well, that fistula first is the same measure?
Well, the fistula first is where they gather the data from.
Right, but the measure, I'm sorry, but I guess what I mean, I understand the data on fistulas, but the question is, of all people who have open procedures, have they looked at how many have these measured? Because that's really what we're asking here.
Right. So to the developer, this, I know you tested the measure. Is there any other, there's no implementation of this measure yet. Is that correct? So the only data specifically on this measure is what's in testing. Is that?
Well, it has been implemented through PQRI, being transitioned to PQRS. But we don't, as you all know, CMS has not released the national data for us to be able to analyze that. But it has indeed been implemented.
Have you requested that from CMS?
I don't know that we've done it in the last few months. I know it's been done previously on other measures, but unless they've changed their policy, it has not been necessarily possible to get the, and again, if you think about the way the measure is structured with the exclusions, I'm not sure that's going to answer the exact gap question, because the in terms of possibility for improvement, which I think is still based on that current literature.
Okay, so this is an endorsed measure with no specific data other than the testing data, but that's the case with some of the other endorsed measures we've looked at. So, you know, the key issue is there still opportunity for improvement in this area?
Well, we do know fistula first data is a similar metric, although this metric takes out catheters, and it's not the same as prevalence under fistula first, which is prevalence of all 3 types of vascular access, where this is saying if a vascular access is created, what percentage are fistulas and what percentage are grafts. But we do know that there's still a gap, that there's many more fistulas could be created. I think we know that from AV first. Jerry?
If I'm reading the specification right, any patient the surgeon feels is not a candidate for fistula is excluded. So that includes graft patients, I think.
Correct. And, I mean, the key part of the specifications is that you have to have documented that a specific reason why a fistula is not in place. In other words, if you're putting a graft in, and the most common would be inadequate vein based on vein mass. But it does not specifically say that that's the only reason.
So let me just, maybe the developer can help me. This feels a little confusing to me. If the surgeon says no, fistulas are not possible here, and those patients are not excluded, so the only ones who are included are those for whom the surgeon in advance thinks a fistula is possible, this then measures the correctness of their pre-op assessment?
No, it really doesn't. I mean, this is very similar to a lot of other process measures that are currently in use, which is, you know, basically just looking at the denominator of patients who are undergoing the procedures. So if the exclusion has to be specifically designated. Okay, so that means a choice. Someone's got to go and say, you know, I understand that a fistula should be placed. This is the reason I'm not. So in the denominator, if no exclusions are, if you will, included, or you don't exclude anybody, they will still be in the denominator regardless of whether you've put in a graft or fistula. Is that, am I making that clear?
But it seems like then that this would be 100%. Is that not?
Well, it should be. I mean, yeah.
Not to be flippant, but it seems like if the options, if you're undergoing an open procedure, I only know of two options, a graft or a fistula. And if we exclude people who aren't fistula candidates, based on, this is fine, but I'm assuming that there's going to be high performance on the measure in general, but maybe I have a misunderstanding, but I think that's kind of what Alan might have been asking.
Right. No, I understand. And I think it's, this is probably not the time to go in a whole discussion about the optimal way to do measures, but I would say that almost every process measure out there that allows patient or physician-level exclusion could receive the same criticism, in terms of the performance should be at 100% if the physician is thinking about it, documenting their rationale. And I guess the counter is to try to, it's just listening to the discussion that you all just had about all these possible other exceptions and the kind of perverse incentives if you don't allow these kind of exclusions of where you end up with, you have a special for doing harm with measurements. But I'd be the first one to say that, and it's true for most of these process measures, in terms of, certainty that the right thing has been done, there's just no way to do that.
Let me try to rephrase Alan's question to the developer. If I'm understanding this correctly, it's testing the success rate of the surgeon in putting the fistula in if he or she up front feels that a fistula should be done. But the problem is that subjectivity at the start, such that if it looks like it's going to be dicey to get a fistula in, they could just say it's not possible and they're excluded. So my question would be, what is to keep this from just becoming a slam dunk kind of measure for the surgeon? They're still going to have some OR failures where it just won't go, and it'll measure that. But it looks like it's going to be 90-95% for any accomplished surgeon. Am I missing something?
Actually, that is not true. The rate of non-maturation of occlusion fistulas have been shown to be close to the 30% range.
But in terms of the question, you are correct. And I think what we're trying to say, and similar to, again, going back to the discussion you just had, the alternative is a very perverse incentive. Okay, as a surgeon, I mean, I can create a fistula in anybody that has almost no chance of success, and meet a measure, charge Medicare, and then come back and finally have to put a graft in or leave the patient with a catheter. For example, I'm taking it to the extreme. So the alternative is either to not accept those types of exclusions where someone's made a reasoned judgment, versus to have a crude measure that says what the percentage of fistulas. And then you get into all the, as I said, the perverse incentives, the variation in practice in terms of what kind of patients are being referred, etc. So that we're certainly open to suggestions about how to do this better, but I'm not sure how to.
Well, I'd like to take a shot at putting it in a little in the paradigm. I think the surgeons look at it from this metric offers a surgeon a chance at 100% if they either decide and successfully place a fistula or they carefully evaluate whether a fistula can be done and they decide no. Where they fall down is if they don't consider the options, document their decision process, and then they go in and put it in a graft. That's where they fail. Do you see what I'm saying? So from a surgeon's point of view, they have the chance to score 100%. It sort of forces them to think about it, fistula, and to document it if they don't think they want to do it.
I think it's also worth pointing out that there's no requirement that the fistula mature or ever be used. It's just create a fistula, which is what we've run into as being one of the unintended consequences of the last several years.
Well, this may allow them a way out, so they're not forced to put in fistulas that they don't think are going to succeed.
Put in a fistula whether it succeeds or not.
If they don't think it's going to succeed, they can write a note saying this is not a fistula candidate, and they still score on the metric.
The metric also doesn't require that it be a functioning fistula.
Right, it doesn't. I mean, that's true. That's...
Yeah, I think what we're getting into would require, in fact, we're working on this in other areas, but really getting the true outcome of that.
Yes.
But that's sort of a different step. This is an endorsed process measure, and we're rapidly working on other measures that will be better and true outcome measures. And that could be to definitely work on down the line, but we're not there yet. This is just sort of a separate issue.
Can I just have a point of clarification? I think somebody mentioned the word 30% non-maturation rate. Did I hear that correctly? Because I think that's truly incorrect, because the largest study that was, since this measure was approved, published in JAMA in 2008, the DAC fistula study, indirectly showed there was 60% failure rate in both the placebo group, and it was a very large study, over 5, I forget how many patients. Now, I don't know if you believe that, but that was a prospective, randomized study. And the failure rate was 60%. I should say, which is also maybe piggybacking on what somebody else said, of usability, I should really make that point, because, yeah, there were fistulas in. It's just that they didn't work. I mean, they were Doppler sound, but they couldn't be used, and so that's another issue. They could never have two needles placed.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mentioned that number, and I should have said at least 30%. You're right about that. It might be more, but the lowest number I've seen is 30%.
All of those arguments, though, would argue for the measure the way it's specified and include the exclusion, because otherwise... You have that perverse incentive to just put in a fistula no matter what to get your quality checked, if you will, regardless of whether that's ever going to be used by the patient or useful at all. So that, I mean, I think that is exactly the reason why the specification is as it is.
Alan?
I guess my problem is without actual data. Oh, should I stop? Sorry.
I was meant to call Ruben. She was first. And my finger just automatically goes to Alan every time. I'm sorry.
All right. I hope you can understand my accent. It's a Puerto Rican. No, I guess my problem is without actual data to review on this metric to see what that really has looked like. It's very hard for me to know if there's really a performance gap that matters or its usability. I surely feel that what I hear the developer discussing makes real sense in terms of finding the right way to incent vascular surgeons to put fistulas as often as they can, but without the measure, it's very hard for me to know whether it accomplishes that or not.
Yeah, part of the problem, and if we just think this through a little bit, with this measure is implemented through PQRI, and if you looked at PQRI across the board for all the measures that are being used in there, the performance rate is very high for all kinds of measures. So, but that doesn't really tell you whether or not a performance gap exists. And if you only use that data, you're going to vastly overestimate performance because under a system where you have voluntary choice, voluntary reporting, people, of course, are the early adopters are the ones that are actually doing this. Are going to pick things that they're going to have a high success rate, and they're going to make sure they have a high success rate. So I'm not sure that data will really tell us whether or not there is a gap. And so you have to turn to more or other data sources to really decide whether or not there still exists a performance gap across the country that this measure could address if it was more widely adopted and used. Does that make sense?
Thanks, that makes sense. Ruben, did Alan speak for you, or you have something?
I never speak. Thank you, Ruben. I think we now understand what this measure as it is measures, but at the end of the day, I'm not sure if this information helps us, and it's more to the developer. I'm not sure it's going to help us in achieving what we want to achieve in the outcome. As it's been well stated, the percentage may be quite high because of the numerator or the denominator.
I agree. And, you know, again, I would only say that we are in the process of, across the board in vascular surgery, of trying to develop true outcome measures that will, you know, ultimately get us where we want to get for a lot of areas across the board in medicine. But I think, you know, if we really look at what's going on, what's endorsed out there right now, the vast majority of them are process measures that all have these kinds of limitations in terms of getting us to where we want to go.
Just one thing we've been conferring a little bit about, and I think it's a good point of, you know, some of the issues about how the measure is constructed and then not having any data to know how that plays out in whether the measure is really going to ultimately tell us something. And we understand that everyone had trouble getting PQRI data from CMS, but something to think about is whether we want to suspend things here and make it a request to get some actual data on this measure and see if, you know, with this kind of holding things up with NQF endorsement, whether that can help get some data from CMS. I don't know. And I guess we could also see whether that's going to, you know, if you want to go ahead and vote on this performance gap as with the information you have, and then we'll see where we're at after that.
Well, I would point out to the committee, if we vote and the result is insufficient data to judge the performance gap, that stops it at this point. And then they can, you know, mm-hmm. take that under advisement and go from there.
And
personally, that's where I'm feeling right now. There's insufficient evidence to judge whether there's a performance gap. Vascular surgeons, between the two options, may be hitting 90-95%. I have no way of knowing.
But again, I would assume that if we were able to get the PQRI data, it's going to have very high performance. But that shouldn't be used. I don't think the PQRI data is the valid way to assess a performance gap. The performance gap has to come from other...
Right, so we have insufficient data. I think that's really what you're saying. We have insufficient data to judge a performance gap.
Well, why isn't the fistula first data... relatively high percentage of grafts versus fistula...
Right, let me just explain. The difference is that, in general, yes, I think the group agrees there is room for improvement about placing fistulas. What we're addressing here is endorsement of a specific measure and how it's specified, and if this measure doesn't really help us identify differences in quality across providers, it's not that useful from a quality performance metric. I think is anyone else want to add to that?
And also the fistula first information, which is improving rapidly even without NQF direct involvement, but is not the same metric. It's a lot different than what this is. And it's true that your performance measurement will be in a limited group of surgeons, I presume, but you explain why if the gap is low, it still may not be accurate. But nevertheless, we need some to see some performance data on this metric. So I think we finally reached a point where we can take a vote, and unless anybody objects, okay? So let's vote on the presence of a performance gap, high, moderate, low, insufficient.
Florian, performance gap?
Insufficient.
Okay, we have 18 voting insufficient and 2 low. So, I think also in the interest of time, we should stop consideration of this metric at this point. Is it true, Karen, that if they were able to loosen some performance data out of CMS and get it to us within weeks, we could still look at
it?
Yeah,
I think so. So, given that potential scenario, do you want to evaluate the evidence or just wait and see what we get, if we get any further? Do you want,
I'm not holding my breath on them getting the performance data in time.
Okay.
So maybe we can
resume this if need be. Okay.
Right. I think we're better off. With about an hour left, we should take on one more and...
Okay, so are there any other, either in the vascular access group, in the patient education quality of life group, or adequacy group of measures that people think would benefit from the full committee discussion?
Well, I'd love to see one of the quality of life tools. We haven't talked about that before, and I know Andy is just aching to lead the discussion.
I think we'll need to review one of the patient education ones. Unfortunately, the quality of life measure was not able to complete the submission, so we really don't have the testing data. So, we had sent it out to you thinking we were going to get some more information. It is something we'd like to have a discussion with you about because it's an extremely important area. The measure that actually got endorsed last year was a process measure of simply using the quality of life assessment, and there's certainly a lot of interest in actually having a patient-reported outcome measure using that data, which is what the preference would be, because obviously just collecting that data doesn't necessarily do anything, but of course that's another whole measurement issue in itself. Lauren and I had an initial discussion with Tom Dudley at CMS because we're interested in this measure, a lot of people at NQF, about whether CMS could consider starting to take this on, and you know, there's certainly some interest, but we have to continue pushing on that. But maybe we'll take a few minutes before we talk about one of the patient education measures to see if any of you have any suggestions or know of people who would be willing to kind of take on a measure of quality of life where it's actually using quality of life data and doing something from a standpoint of a patient-reported outcome. Lisa?
Well, what I know, and I don't have any answers, is that there's a subcommittee of the QASC that I'm on, the Quality of Life Steering Committee, a subcommittee called the Patient-Reported Measures, as you know, Karen, Patient-Reported Measures Work Group, that is led by Deborah Ness and Michael Barr from ACP. And so we're in the process of going through sort of all the measures that are out there, and I'm not sure if there's something that can be gleaned from that work group that would inform this
right.
process.
And I'll just mention NQF is actually starting a project that I'm going to be involved in that's on patient-reported outcomes, and we're doing an initial project related to the methodological issues. So I'll just give you a brief we've dealt with huge methodological issues for all the measures, and in some ways they pale in comparison to when we start talking about patient-reported outcomes. So even though these instruments have often been considered very reliable and valid when you're doing patient-level measurement and have been used in research studies when you have random assignment of patients to treatment and non-treatment groups, when you start thinking of then taking that data and aggregating it to get a facility-level performance measure, you have to think about risk adjustment. You need to think about, do you aggregate it at like an average, percent improved, percent who achieve a benchmark? There are many big issues with that. So that's what that project that's starting up very soon is really going to try to delve into some of those methodological issues of taking these very good, reliable, and valid patient-reported outcome measures at the patient level and what needs to be done, what's the pathway to getting them to being useful as a performance measure. So. Michael, I think the VA's done some work on not on that particular.
Well, I was going to just, my experience with this has been with in the ASK and CRIT cohort studies in chronic kidney disease, where we've looked at QOL with SF36 and then the KDQOL in CRIT. But I think you've outlined there are significant methodologic challenges. I mean, it's one thing to assess it, which I think is probably not so controversial, but to move past that, and then try to relate that to an outcome measure and try somehow, as you said, kind of risk adjust, I think will be no small task, which it sounds like you guys are kind of deep in right now already. On the VA side of things, Karen, I don't know, at least in terms of CKD and ESRD, there's a lot of talk about patient self-management and getting data with patient-reported outcomes, but I don't know if formal research that at least that I'm aware of, in the specific domains of CKD and ESRD.
And maybe I'm going to back up here and say maybe it's worthwhile talking about that quality of life measure, because I'd like to see, I mean, if this steering committee really feels that it has some value in moving forward, we can have, you know, pursue more discussions with CMS as being able to collect that information. I mean, obviously the KDQOL has, from the patient level data, there's reliability and validity information. It's just the process measure has never been implemented, tested, and so I don't want to prematurely cut it off, and I'd like to see if you all have any suggestions of a path forward or what, how you would like to, and I forget who we had review that in meeting, but go ahead.
It's Harvey?
Yeah,
Harvey Wells.
Harvey, yeah, you looked at the measure what was there, so.
Yeah, I figured Lauren gave this to me because it was doomed to fail, but I do think it's important. I remember when I filled this thing out in center, and when I filled this out after I was at home, it just struck me. My answers were so different. And I think it's important. I mean, as we talk about all these measures, I mean, a lot of them are based on lab outcomes and whatever, but I think what's really important to patients is, you know, how has it changed their quality of life? Are they able to continue with their lives as they want to or as they choose? And I think, to me, real true quality measures from a patient perspective is how it's affecting my life. And I can tell you, I mean, I've experienced two different outcomes. And one, I was able to continue my life, and one, I thought my life was over. So I do think it's important. I do, you know, this measure, as it's presented, did not have, you know, sufficient data to evaluate and review it. But I do believe that it's something that's worth pursuing and getting the patient perspective on their, on how they feel the treatments are going.
The KDQOL is also a part of the conditions for coverage, and under and it's used by the facilities in their quality improvement, and so those patient-related measures within the KDQOL that are below average are what the facility is supposed to be focusing on for quality improvement. And And so there may be a way of using that. It's the percent of patients that fall in that below average category and then showing improvement as you do interventions through the plan of care. So there might be something there that you might be able to.
So if it's mandated, is it mandated that every patient have
every patient except for those with these exclusions that are in the denominator exclusion are the same exclusions that are in the conditions for coverage. And the surveyors do review this at each survey, and it's the percent of patients that have a below average score, and then what they want to see is a plan of care attached to that and how you're going to improve that below average score.
I just think that there is evidence. I mean, I think the importance of assessing QL and the relationships, at least the epi relationships between QL and mortality and other outcomes, there's reasonable evidence in CKD and ESRD, I guess, but moving past that in terms of, this has come up with other things, what do you do specifically to improve QOL, and where's the evidence for that, and if that occurs, does that lead to a change in an outcome downstream, or is QL in itself a defined outcome like mortality? I think those are areas that there's not a lot of evidence that I'm aware of. I mean, you could argue that quality of life doesn't have to be linked to something like mortality or hospitalization. In and of itself could be a defined terminus of an outcome. But even then you're left with, so QL, because there's, you know, there's a mental health, there's different composite scores of the MCS and a PCS. And I mean, then which part are you exactly intervening on, and where's the data that actually changes things, and what would be those processes? I mean, assume those are the types of things, Karen, that you all may be kind of working through now.
Well, that is one of the, I mean, you know, we're going to be having some white papers on the methodological issues, but that is one of the questions about sensitivity to change or clinical intervention, you know, doing condition-specific things versus general, you know, more global patient-reported outcomes. So,
yeah, I mean, there's a basic difference here, though. I think it's critical to define. The KVQOL and the other tools we've used, doctors have made up, social workers have made up. We kind of come up with these categories and then validate them and see each of the dimensions. And in each study we've done, like we've done in FHN, we've got lots of good data on those objective measures. But the patient-derived measures are just a different realm. And I keep hearing that our measures, the ones that professional people design, have their place and importance, but we haven't paid nearly enough attention to the patient-defined measures. And to me, that's the area I think we need to pay more attention to and develop ways of examining that here at NQF.
Not surprisingly, of course, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, we talk about this a lot, of course, within the patient advocate community that I work with. And it's functional wellness. It's participation in life. It's all the things that are very intangible and tough to quantify, but that are very meaningful. And yes, with all due respect, of course, the tools we've come up with so far are useful, but they always tend to have sort of a clinical perspective in there, and this is a little different. So I think Alan's point is extremely well taken. Thank you.
We happen to be sitting in a room of people that are interested in kidney disease, but this issue really has brought up application to anybody with a chronic medical disease. And I wonder what NQF's position is more broadly in chronic disease management and patient quality of life issues. Are there, for instance, do the heart failure people or any other medical surgical specialty seem to have an inside track on getting their arms around this issue where we might learn from them? Or are they in the same kind of dire straits we are?
Well, I can tell you that I think everyone's kind of at the same place. There have been things brought into other projects, and I know in the cardiovascular project, for example, one of the, I don't know if it was the Seattle Angina questionnaire or what, some patient-reported measure, but the issues about what's the performance measure? You know, everybody agrees that's a reliable and valid measure at the patient level, but what are you suggesting we do at the performance measure level? I think the only one that I can mention right off that has NQF endorsement, and it may have gotten it as time limited, was bringing in a depression scale. Patient-reported depression scale. I believe it was the PHQ-9, and having a performance measure based on change, I think. And I don't have the details of that. But in terms of these issues, it's really across the board that people are struggling with, and that's one of the reasons we're doing this project, to look at the methodological issues more across the board. So that, because there's a huge clamor for, you know, performance measures based on patient-reported data and the things that matter most to patients, function, you know, well-being, those kinds of things. And even you know, from the standpoint of, I know the from eye surgery group, you know, they're looking at patient-reported visual function after eye surgery, which, you know, that's what matters. Does the patient think they can see? And, you know, people are looking at those in terms of after knee and hip surgery. But this bringing it to the level of a performance measure has been, it's not solved anywhere that I know of.
So, Karen, one other question. What about the ambulatory care project? Because I remember some years ago when I was on that project that there were some things for depression and anxiety. Did those, one of them was time limited, but I think the other one didn't pass. Did Did they have any...
Was it an actual patient reported scale?
It was a patient.
I can't answer that. I'd have to check. I mean, the other thing is, as you all know, and I should mention here too, NQF has endorsed the measures associated with the CAPS instruments. And in the last project, the ESRD CAPS was endorsed. And it's due for endorsement maintenance. And the reason you don't have it in your materials here is because ARC has had some cutbacks and they didn't have the resources to maintain the measure in time for this project. Again, we had some conversations with CMS about that because CMS is very interested, and CMS and ARC are now talking about maintaining that measure. And luckily, NQF is going to be doing a project, I think, early next year, specifically on patient experience. So we'll be able to, that measure will continue to be endorsed, and it will come through endorsement maintenance with some other patient experience measures. So I just wanted to kind of assure you that's not going away, but it's kind of the realities of resources at this point in time. Okay. So, maybe what we can do is at least begin going through one of the patient education measures. They're similar, one facility and one physician level, and then we'll probably only get through one of them, but I think then it'll be easy for us to pick up on the other one. So,
right, we should stop at three so we have time for...
Yes.
Comments, next steps, and adjournment 5 through 15.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
So let's do the facility level one, 0324.
Karen, do you want us to start with remarks?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. So Lisa, you want to present the measures?
Okay. Again, both of these measures are from the Kidney Care Quality Alliance. We've submitted measure 0324, Patient Education Awareness Facility Level, and 0320, Patient Education Awareness Clinician Level. Both measures were endorsed by NQF in 2008 and are included among CMS's Phase 3 Clinical Performance Measures. The Phase 3 CPMs are slated for use by CMS in its Crown Web Dialysis Facility Data Repository when it becomes functional. The physician level measure was field tested in clinician offices coincident with the AMA PCPI renal measures, and the facility level measure was tested at 53 dialysis facilities across the United States. The underlying rationale for both measures, which are identical, as Karen mentioned, except for the level of analysis, is to ensure that all ESRD patients are educated on all available renal replacement therapy options, hemodialysis, home hemo, peritoneal dialysis, transplants, and identification of living donors, and no or cessation of renal replacement therapy at least once yearly. The measures are consistent with the CMS conditions for coverage and a body of evidence demonstrating that patients knowledgeable about dialysis are more likely to use an AVF as vascular access, have less depression and improved medication adherence and treatment attendance, and are more likely to survive and to get transplants than their less well-informed counterparts. In particular, we'd like to reference a June 2011 study that wasn't included in the initial measure submission form because it's too new. The study demonstrated that attendees of a national pre-dialysis treatment program that provided education about modality options more frequently selected home dialysis and had lower catheter rates and mortality risk during the first 90 days of dialysis when compared with period prevalent infant patients who didn't participate in the program. In the study, the unadjusted early mortality hazard ratio is found to be 0.51 for program attendees, and after adjusting for case mix and laboratory values, the hazard ratio was 0.61 for program attendees, and all outcomes, P was less than 0.001. Also, I'd like to note an error that was in the measure submission form regarding the clinician level measure. Under Summary of Evidence for Performance Gap, which is Section 1B2, The form indicates that the performance rate in physicians' offices during field testing was 97%. What should be indicated is that the rate when assessing the number of patients educated on at least one renal replacement therapy option was 97%. An additional paragraph is omitted in which it was noted that to receive credit for the measure, patients must be educated on all six of the modalities addressed in the measure, and none of the patients included in the sample methods criterion, so the physician level performance rate was actually 0%. The facility performance rate, as was accurately noted in the measure submission, was 16.4% during field testing, meaning that there was a significant gap in care in both settings. And we'd again like to thank you for your consideration of the measure, and we welcome any questions now or after your deliberation.
And actually, I can let you guys decide, Andy and Kathy, which measure you want to talk about, or if we can talk about them together. It's the same measure, mm-hmm. and then we, if there are issues, we can bring them up. Okay, so Kathy, you want to start?
Before you start,
yes.
Is it possible to ask them one specific question about the information that could not be presented because of the newness of the information?
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the earlier in the equation we could have the patients educated and given options, perhaps the better for everyone involved. How was it that those patients were identified and able to participate in a pre-ESRD study?
Okay, this is the Laxon et al. Paper that was published in June in the American Journal of Kidney Disease. It was done at Fresenius Medical Care. I don't have the exact how they were able to identify the patients, but they were all within Fresenius, so they were recruited that way, similar to what they did for their Right Start program when they studied that. Does that answer your question?
Nope. Actually, the Right Start data that is cited cites incident dialysis patients. And, yeah, and so is it the same curriculum, but a different group of patients?
Yeah, this is a different curriculum. They focus specifically on educating the patients on available modality options rather than going into all of the stuff that the Right Start did. It focused just on this talk. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, can I say Right Start is different from TOPS? Yes, okay. I'm sorry.
Kathy, you want to give us a description of the measure, and then we'll get into the rest.
Yes, thank you. Well, we are looking at renewing these two very similar measures. It is a percentage of the physician's end-stage renal disease patients aged 18 years and older with medical record documentation of a discussion of renal replacement therapy modalities, which to include hemodialysis, peritoneal dialysis, home hemodialysis, transplants, and identification of potential living donors, as well as a no treatment or cessation of treatment option at least once during the 12-month reporting period. The numerator would be the number of patients from the denominator, again, with medical record documentation that a discussion did occur, including all of those above listed options. And the denominator would be all of the ESRD patients aged 18 years and older. Feel free to step in, Andy, anytime. Talking about impact, high impact, education programs for chronic kidney disease patients have shown to delay the time to dialysis and improve survival, and it indicates that patients with greater knowledge about dialysis at initiation are more likely to use an AV fistula or graft than a catheter. The Right Start patients that we were talking about had significantly improved mental composite scores and reduced hospitalization and mortality rates compared to control subjects, demonstrating that a structured program of prompt medical and educational strategies in incident hemodialysis patients resulted in improved morbidity and mortality that lasts up to a year.
Well, since a third of our patients, meet the nephrologist when they're having the catheter inserted, it's not hard to argue that there's an educational gap. I think a lot of the data that's presented concerns pre-dialysis education and its impact prior to initiation. And I think overall one of the issues in looking at these two measures is clearly there's a big educational gap, whether this measure would address that educational gap.
The horse is out of the barn, in a sense, because the denominator is ESRD patients on dialysis.
Right, and you know there's most of what's cited and most of the experience relates to the interventions that are done prior to initiation of dialysis.
Right, right.
There's very little to support the kind of intervention that's described in this measure.
A related issue, which may be better, I'm not sure this comes under validity, but this is really just looking for check marks in a sense. You know, there's a note in the chart. You know, what is that? Does that equal effective education? I know that's, you know, I'm not sure where that should be discussed or considered, but.
Probably under validity. So, Connie?
Just another comment about this is also a participation in the conditions for coverage issue as well, and it is that facilities are required under the conditions of coverage to provide modality education in all of these topics. I think it's within the first 6 treatments and then yearly thereafter. And there's not a measure of the quality of the education. It's, as you said, Peter, it's a checkbox that the patients have been educated on this. So this is also a measure that's being monitored through CMS through the survey process.
It is, and while you're right about them not addressing the quality of the education, they do specifically say that whether or not the facility offers the treatments, they have to educate on them, which I think, frankly, from a patient's perspective, has been historically a problem. So there is that particular stipulation.
So maybe what we'll do is, I mean, obviously you have some questions about the measure specification. So I guess first let's try to go back to impact. And I guess the question is, does patient education impact outcomes? And I think you're right. Then the question is, does this measure actually fit with, you know, the opportunity for improvement and evidence, et cetera? Does that make sense, Andy?
Well, whether or not this effectively causes changes in outcomes, I think it's, you can easily vote, this is important, that it should have high impact.
Just a clarification, the Right Start program and the impact programs both are not pre-dialysis, they're both in the first 90 days of dialysis, just so it is on folks that have already started.
Well, this does define the the numerator as ESRD patients. So, but certainly there's no argument that CKD patients probably need it even more.
So I think unless someone has a burning issue, we can at least vote on the impact, high, moderate, low, or insufficient. Are we ready? All right, let's go.
Lorian, are you still there? Impact?
For impact, moderate.
There's 21. So we have 11 voting high, 9 moderate, and 1 low. Okay, now on to the performance gap. And just right on, as long as my mic's on, this is a required Medicare condition for coverage. Can we assume it's always being done, and therefore there's no performance gap? I mean, you don't get paid without it.
But the data presented.
Anyway, that was just
Andy
a.
And Kathy.
Prove me wrong.
One would assume that, but according to the conclusions from the studies that are cited in this, the findings are that at both the facility and physician's office level indicate that a majority of ESRD patients are not being educated on all renal replacement therapy options. And also that provider performance varies significantly by modality, again, leaving out treatments that they may not offer. So it did identify a significant clinical gap.
This is based on looking for documentation as opposed to asking the patient whether they received education. Is that right? Okay.
So is the gap then maybe in documentation and not actual?
Maybe there's a gap in education, but no gap in documentation. If you look at the USRDS, when they did the they reported on data for meeting healthy people 2010, they reported data on percentage of patients who had a discussion of transplant. And even though, and it was very high, but I think that's a box. Is that a box on 2728 or somewhere along the way? So I think the point that Karen raises is very important. It's one thing to have a sort of a checkoff box. It's another thing to have some documentation and some patient understanding.
Well, and it's not just understanding, it's effective decision-making. So
sure.
There's a big leap here about I've done my job, I've given you information, and then what happens to that information? We are making a leap.
Just a question about the performance gap. Was the assessment done after or sufficiently long after this had become a condition of coverage?
Before.
So it really isn't evidence of a current performance gap. My suspicion was, what's proven to be correct, is that the assessment of the performance gap was prior to this becoming a condition of coverage. So that since it's become a condition of coverage, we don't have evidence of a performance gap.
Okay, more, yes.
Can I make a comment to Dr. Narva? Sometimes patients are sent for education maybe a year out before they need dialysis. So they've been educated. Some of them have a fistula. Some of them may not. And they come to the clinic, and they're assessed, and the nurse asks, did you attend the TOPS class? Were you educated? Well, I remember when I was on dialysis. I forgot a lot of stuff, you know, so it also, the gap could also be if the patient doesn't remember. Because we do have some patients, I had one patient that she came to class 4 years before she started dialysis. So.
Well, but that's why I asked the question too of, is this performance gap data based on documentation rather than asking the patients what they remember? And I was told, yes, it is.
No.
So,
No, it's not?
No. I'm sorry. Okay, well, please explain someone.
It's based on, at the point of time within the first 6 treatments, that you are obligated to educate the patient on each of these conditions, so each of the modality, treatment modality options. And then you got what your documentation is that, yes, you have educated those the patient on each of those.
That's and then provision and the conditions for
that's
coverage.
That's where the conditions for coverage are written, yeah.
That's not this measure.
No.
This measure is only documentation that this happened. Whether it was 10 years ago or 2 days ago.
No, it's documentation within the year.
In a 12-month period, right. But documentation. The documentation
right.
Could have happened at the office level.
But I do think the salient point from what Bobby said is that exactly the percentage that Dr. Narva cited, a good third of these patients are being educated at a time when they are overwhelmed with a new diagnosis. They're sick. They're starting dialysis treatment. It's not a great time to do education. So I think that's a very important part about it, having the 12 months and repeated. Also, things change. You go from a modality, you are transplanted, you go back to dialysis. Very important that that opportunity be repeated.
Again, the way I read this measure is documentation that this was explained. Again, this could have been done a year before, and there's documentation in my chart today that I did this last year. And that's all it requires in that 12-month period. That's the way I read this measure.
You're correct, but within the conditions for coverage, you're obligated to repeat it. And I think, the gap performance is based on pre-condition for coverage, patient education.
But the specifications
say, and we'll ask the developer, the specifications say at least once during the 12-month period. So
right, if the education occurred at least once during the 12-month period. Documentation that that education occurred at least once per year.
So let me ask it this way, because I think this is your question. So you may document it every year, but your documentation may be that I told them 2 years ago.
No, documentation that the education occurred at least once a year.
Okay. All right. Got it?
Okay. Thank you.
So it doesn't mean that they heard it.
Well, we understand that, but
okay.
But in terms of trying to judge the performance gap, we need to know that this metric was done, and the data we have here is that depending on which modality you're talking about, the gap was, the performance was between 30 and 80%, depending on the modality. Is that, am I reading that right? Okay, so I judge that to mean there is a performance gap. So that's what I'm going to vote. And are the rest of you ready to vote? Okay. High, moderate, low, or insufficient?
Florian?
For performance gap, high.
Four votes high, 10 moderate, 1 low, 6 insufficient. Okay. You must have voted insufficient. I'm just... okay, so we're to the point where we can... this is a process, not a health outcome, so we can look at the body of evidence. Andrew or Kathleen, somebody want to step us through it quickly?
This is from the application, which says, while several studies have demonstrated, this focuses on renal replacement modalities, while several studies have demonstrated an association between patient education and improved in outcomes in the ESRD population, none were identified that focused exclusively on renal replacement modality options, as is the case with this patient education measure. So
so the quantity is zero, or it's not closely related to the metric?
It's not. The evidence out there doesn't relate to this measure.
The evidence says education leads to better outcomes, kind of a general...
Yes.
In all settings or pre-dialysis settings.
Yeah, we asked you to consider the supplemental study that we've included since then, the top study as well. And that's the only one available at this point in time on pre-dialysis modality education.
But that intervention is also very different from, that's an extensive curriculum, is that correct?
So let me just... kind of bring it back on evidence, you know, obviously it would be indirect evidence and requires
indirect
some assumption. The other thing is that we do, if you wish to invoke it, we do have an exception for areas where there's really not going to be evidence and it's based on expert opinion. So so we could rate this body of evidence on patient education, it would be indirect, which is part of the quality assessment. And then we can talk about, you know, if the evidence is really not sufficient, then the next step would be whether you want to move forward based on expert opinion. Does that make sense? Okay.
So could we move to agree that the body of evidence would not be sufficient, but that... Okay. I was going to try and save a couple of minutes. Okay. So let's vote on the quantity.
Okay.
Okay. So one high, two moderate, three low, four insufficient.
Florian, quantity?
Low.
So we have 2 votes moderate, 6 low, 13 insufficient. Okay, quality of body of evidence. So we vote? Okay. Turn on the clock. Thank you.
Lorian?
Insufficient. Okay. And the results are 1 high, 3 moderate, 4 low, 13 insufficient evidence. And consistency.
Lorian?
So there's, because there's insufficient evidence, there's insufficient consistency. Okay, 18 insufficient, 4 low, 1 moderate.
16.
Try that again. 16 insufficient, 4 voted low, 1 voted moderate. So now we can get to the point where we may consider overriding this due to expert opinion.
Right. So next slide.
If there's no empirical evidence and expert opinion is systematically assessed with agreement that the benefits to patients greatly outweigh potential harm, is it judged that potential benefits to patients clearly outweigh potential harms? Can we just go ahead and vote?
Do you want to discuss this?
Did I state it clearly? Okay, let's vote.
Okay, Lorian, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, it is a considered opinion of this august body that the expert opinion should carry this measure forward. 18 yes, 3 no.
Okay.
So
I think then we've passed importance to measure and report. Yes. Okay. So I know we're
pushing the envelope. We have 10 minutes.
Okay. All right.
We can do this in 10 minutes.
Okay. Good.
All right. So reliability testing. This is an existing metric.
Right.
So there should be some data on.
Right. And there is.
Well, the right start that was cited, I think only 16% of patients were educated on all modalities.
Okay, what we're going to look at now is the specifications and the reliability testing for this measure. So under 2A2, they did some testing in both the facilities and physician office. So they did inter-rater reliability and provided some data on that. And I don't know if, Andrew, you want to say anything about that? I'm trying to see if I can pull up the...
I think the issues there related to defining what education was.
A Kappa statistic of 0.0026 for inter-rater reliability, looking at the same data being extracted by 2 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a high cap, a low cap, a low
enough
cap?
What is it?
0.0026 with a 95% confidence interval.
Is this in a table or?
I'm looking on here.
Yeah. And we want to note that this is, we're talking about the facility measure, right? Because the,
right.
Yes.
The reliability statistics differ.
Table 2.
Table 2, attachment A.
Okay. Okay, so we need to open up the...
Yeah, I think there's a decimal point error in that kappa.
.026
That is correct. It's -0.0026
Oh, that's a negative. Yes. And, oh, I didn't.
So, and do you want to comment on that, Lisa?
This is why we don't think it can be done in 10 minutes
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So. Based on the literature, negative kappa value indicates that the auditor obtained the same results as the facility objector, less than would be expected by chance alone. There was also a relatively low concordance rate, again demonstrating substantial inter-abstractor disagreement. However, when we reviewed this data, we did not believe that the negative kappa and low inter-rater concordance was due to unreliability of the measure specifications or tool per se, because the type of error was not random, and all of this is demonstrated in the tables here. Rather, significantly more errors were misinformation that led to underreporting, in other words, false negatives. So when we went back into the facilities to review the chart, they had educated on various things that they had not given themselves credit for. Further, the underreporting often stemmed from an apparent lack of understanding by some facilities as to what constituted education, and was documented in the records for the purpose of the measure specification. One particular problem was end-of-life discussion and advanced directives regarding cessation of renal therapy. Other facilities seemed to get it and did perform very well. So we just thought that it was perhaps that some facilities were not educated well enough on how to collect this data. Distribution among the facilities, the errors among the facilities was not even. There was a bimodal distribution, again suggesting that some facilities got it and some did not. And when we went into the physician's office, there was almost perfect reliability between the two expert abstractors, the people who knew what to look for, and they were able to get a very high kappa, 0.8474. So we performed some additional facility-by-facility error analyses and reliability analyses by data elements, and these are also described in detail in the measure submission form. We believe that it demonstrates that the patient education measures can be reliably collected and that the negative kappa for the overall patient education measure performance is not an indication that the specifications are unreliable. We believe that improving the instructions and educating facilities to recognize what constitutes meeting the specifications should reduce the high numbers of false negatives. Again, when reduction scenarios of the high false positive rates were analyzed, kappas indicate excellent agreement and reliability. Also, ongoing implementation of the new conditions for coverage, which require these education modalities to be discussed, we believe it will improve the reliability by sensitizing facility personnel to organize their record keeping better, so they will be more able to reliably collect the data elements. We also wanted to note that when we were going in over the course of the year of data collection, we noticed that the facilities way of keeping track of this was actually changing over the year as they were becoming used to the idea of conditions for coverage. So they were already improvising and coming up with new ways to track this data. Finally, implementation of Crown Web and accountability for patient education can improve reliability by deploying more detailed instructions in training and by sensitizing facility personnel.
So I think that, because it's the same data that you collected looking in facility records and physician records, and the difference was you had two kind of expert abstractors versus a facility person and an expert abstractor.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd like to ask the developer, right now these patient education measures are not a part of Crown Web, and at this point, at least
having been active in the Crown Web process, I don't know that they are going to be a part of the Crown Web.
All we can do is report that we had a conversation with CMS last month, and they remain very interested in pursuing this incorporation. The time frame for that build-out, obviously, is something we don't know.
Other questions or discussion about reliability? So I think what their data shows is that there's the potential to have, you know, a reliable measure, and most of the testing we get is on a small sample and, you know, shows the potential. I think you have to weigh, you know, the difference in the methods and in terms of looking at these results.
So we're not going to get through this measure, apparently. So should we go ahead and vote on reliability, or would people like to think about it a little bit more? I see we're getting some tokens held up in the air, spun and run in circles.
Okay. Well, why don't we vote on reliability, and then we can pick up this measure later, resume it at our first opportunity.
Okay. So let's vote on reliability. High, moderate, low, or insufficient evidence.
Florian?
Moderate.
And the final vote of the day. 11 moderate, 8 low, 2 insufficient. So if you add insufficient to low, moderate barely carries, 11 to 10. So, 11, moderate, 8, low, 2, insufficient. Thank you. So we're at that point where we're going to stop our evaluation of metrics. We will, first of all, open the phones and the floor for public comment. So does anybody here or on the phone wish to make any more comments at this time? Okay, well, that's...
And we have some audience, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Measure developers, anyone else in the room, on the phone? Okay, thank you. So, Karen, what are we going to... How are we going to proceed from here? You and Lauren got it all figured out now?
The first thing is scheduling conference calls. So you will be getting emails from us very quickly to get some calls set up, and we'll be working on... a process to try to accomplish the rest of the measures. I think it helps that we have some discussion in all of the topic areas, because I think that'll ground us, you know, going forward. So I appreciate that. Jeff?
Given what I'm sure is going to be great difficulty in getting a conference call with this group, would it be possible, or would it make sense to divide into two or three groups and try to get the work done that way based upon just availability? So if you get a third or half of people available for one call, and you do it, and another half for another group?
Yeah, we can certainly look at all those options.
But we do need a confirming vote now.
Right.
And we can do all the voting into the computer system. And I have to say, Karen, when I wanted to get a metric to come back up again, putting my name in and putting the same number in, it gave me a clean sheet. So if I don't like the way I voted before, am I stuck with what I...
No. We would have to set up a different tool for this,
okay.
but so that you could go back... So we have a lot of kind of logistical things to try to think out how to best move forward and coordinate with your time and, be most efficient and thorough. So, if you have some suggestions, I think certainly if we need, we don't expect that we'll ever get 100% on a conference call, but we'll, generally look at multiple options and pick the option with the most, but we may have to do several calls and we'll have to move forward with a substantial majority versus 100%. We won't...
Let me kind of summarize some next steps and a little more concretely. It will be expected that the steering committee members will at some point in time
And they can't start right away, because if you go home tonight and start putting in votes, they're not going to count. Okay, but at some point in time, you'll be instructed to finish your evaluation of the measures and to vote. And is that...
Right. So let me ask you this, because it was kind of where I was going originally this morning. We have two ways we could do this. One is to get together on a conference call and have more discussion, and then vote. The other way would be to set up a voting on the measures that we have yet to vote on, by everyone to do that before the call, and then use the call to review those results and discuss any discrepancies or potential areas where there were issues. So I want to just get a feel. I mean,
well, one difference between what we were proposing this morning and the situation we're in now is that
we were going to have discussion,
right? And if we just go back and start voting, we won't have had an opportunity for discussion, and we need to hear Alan's opinion, or we can't vote intelligently. I mean, let's say, as well as many other people. So maybe another option. This is where smaller groups could come in too. For instance, if I'm just thinking out loud, but let's say a group of mineral enthusiasts got together and they discussed and voted. What would we do with that? Would that help us, or restore us to come back?
Yeah, I think we still need to come back. So, yes, Lisa.
I would suggest that you set up calls by domain, and you use a Doodle survey to set up the calls with the measure reviewers. You set up a time where the measure reviewers all agree they can attend, with the rest of us optional as schedules allow. The measure reviewers review the measures, you know, come up with their votes on each. Then we as a group come together and then can just quickly go through based on that.
All right. So we'll, like I said, we have to go back and think about logistics and maintaining the integrity of the process, and we'll get with you as quickly as we can, but we will start getting scheduled as quickly as possible.
So don't start voting on anything yet until you get instructions, but please be looking for and respond to meeting invitations as soon as possible. We want to get that calendared as soon as possible.
Karen, is it possible to have the stewards present at the time of final voting, if at all possible? Because I think it really helps with some of the clarification. And
yes, definitely. All the conference calls will be open, and stewards invited and open to the public. Yes, definitely. Okay.
Joe, you were asking what kind of timeline were time frame, and originally you wanted to have the committee's work done by next week, but last week. So
we're just going to have to deal with that. So
to be determined. Okay.
We've got reality in our face. So
any other at this point? We have a couple minutes left. Would anybody on the committee like to make any comments about their experience, the process, suggestions for improvement? Myra.
One suggestion, in terms of some of the introductory stuff that we went through, perhaps that should be a teleconference a week before the meeting, and perhaps having the individual work groups have a one-hour call to go over things that will kind of speed things up, so that when everybody's in a group, we may move a little bit faster.
Good, thank you. Other comments, suggestions? Okay.
Feel free to send us emails, and we appreciate all of you.
We really, really appreciate your time and
thinking
focus.
Power. I know it made everyone tired, and we appreciate all the energy and time you committed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please leave your voting remotes.
Oh, yeah. Leave your voting remotes, and safe travels for everyone.